Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is writer Philip Hoare. He's a professor of creative writing at the University of Southampton, and we're talking about his book, Albert and the Whale, Albrecht Dürer, and How Art Imagines Our World. Philip, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
It's my huge pleasure to be here, Mark. Thank you very much.
I consider this a special book because of your writing and also the subject matter, which is in the way that you deal with it. How would you describe this book to an audience who has never heard of you before?
Yeah, that's a difficult one, isn't it?
Yeah, I know. I've tried it. I've used words like it's a meditation, a conceptual journey. You go.
Yeah, those are maybe good words. I think it's a bit like a dream.
Yep. Very oneric.
Thank you.
Well, you know, I noticed that you teach creative writing, and a lot of people don't realize that nonfiction can be creative when you write it.
Yeah, I mean, why bore people? I've come to realize, I mean, this is my ninth book, so I've come to realize that actually the thing about writing something which is based on fact is that you don't necessarily have to include all the boring bits. You know, you don't have to know the entire genealogy of your subject, you know, who their great-great-great-grandparents were. So I just realized I just pick out the good bits, really.
Well, also, there's a real passion for digression, and I love that because the story meanders through time and space. Really intriguingly, in every place you go, it ends up there's Albrecht Dürer and there's whales.
I know, it's kind of it's not predestination, I don't think. I mean, it is because. Maybe I intuit that, I don't know, but I think it's like you realize that you are being led along sometimes, and yeah. I sometimes felt I was following a path, really, for me, that he'd sort of laid, in a way, these kind of traps, in a way.
Yeah, it's fascinating, and I had no idea where the book was going or how it was going to end. But at the end, it was really...
Neither did I.
I get that feeling. But in the end, it was really about looking at how you experienced his drawings and works. And that became very, very personal towards the end of the book.
Yeah, I guess that's because I was dealing with a man who lived 500 years before me. And I thought, how can I even possibly enter his world, know what was important to him, how he functioned, and I just try to think of the world through his eyes. And because he is this amazing artist, because he's great genius at recording the natural world, but then also uniquely, I think, almost amongst sort of artists or people of his time, he left a really detailed journey of parts of his life, which meant that I could actually follow in his footsteps.
It becomes a fascinating figure in your book. He becomes almost the start of the modern way of doing art.
Yeah, because he was born either side of the sort of medieval to modern period. He was born in 1471, died in 1528. So pretty much the year 1500 is almost slightly arbitrary, the time at which the medieval left for the modern. And as I say in the book, I said, you know, before Dürer, dragons existed. After him, they didn't.
Yeah.
It's almost as though he was part of that process by fixing nature. So in such an astonishing way, you know, his paintings of the natural world, suddenly the world isn't full of mysterious beasts. It's full of extraordinary things which are extraordinary for their own sake, not because of any kind of myth.
And that's where whales come in. Talk to me about Albrecht and his whales, because the whales becomes this weird thing that he goes on a journey for and is completely frustrated from.
Yeah, because I think I realized that, rather like me, he was fascinated with whales when he was a kid. You know, we know that he probably read the works of Albertus Magnus, who is a medieval monk who was the first person to really describe whales accurately in the modern world. So you sort of cut to the year 1520, and he's in the Low Countries. He's fleeing Nuremberg, his hometown, because the plague has broken out there. And he's in Antwerp, and he hears that a whale is stranded in the coast of Zeeland. And so some of him and his drinking buddies, his gambling buddies, a great drinker and a gambler, and they get set off on this boat to try and reach this whale. There's a huge storm. They nearly all drown. And, of course, when he gets there, the storms wash this whale away. But the significance of that, I think, is that if any of your listeners who know Dürer's rhinoceros, which is probably the most famous rhinoceros ever depicted, this extraordinary plated, tank-like creature, which was an incredibly successful image for him. He created a print and went to 8 editions. I kind of think he thought if he saw this whale, this would be his new hit engraving. This would be a really popular thing. And also, he'd faced so many challenges, the biggest challenge of all in the natural world, to draw the Leviathan. I think that's what drew him on.
What's also fascinating in your book is you also bring in art historians commenting on Dürer, like Panofsky. He described this trip as the most important event in his later years. Do you agree with that?
I do. Without sort of having a spoiler alert, it's actually the point at which Dürer becomes ill, in fact. He probably catches malaria when he's in the marshy swamps of Zeeland, which is where this whale is stranded. So in Dürer's mind, that becomes a kind of... Was it an act of arrogance that he sort of, you know, he was depicting the natural world? Is that almost blasphemous for an artist to do that, to depict what God has made so accurately? So there's this, of course, he believed, because he was sort of coming from this medieval background, he believed in the humours, he believed alchemy, or these things that the stars, he believed he worked under the star of Saturn. He believed it was a star which was the star of melancholy. So there's all of this, but at the same time he's looking to the future and to humanism and rationalism and all that. So yeah, I think it's a really key point.
I'm fascinated by his creatures, his animals. You talked about the rhinoceros. There's the very famous hare. I was not that familiar with the walrus, though. The walrus is one odd drawing.
It's really odd.
It's spooky.
It is.
Go ahead. You talk about it.
Well, he probably only ever saw the head of a walrus. He probably only saw a decapitated walrus.
That may explain it. But it has life. It has sort of a weird personality.
Yeah, it has these big bug eyes and those great big tusks.
Yeah.
I always see in his animals, I see the kind of human, even though he's drawing these animals in a very realistic way, like the hare, which is, when you look at the hare, the eyes of the window, the window of the room in which he's sitting, this hare is sitting, or she is sitting, reflects the eyes of the wind of the kitchen that Dürer is painting the hare in. And that's exactly the same technique that Dürer and many other portraitists used in human beings, the window reflected was the eyes of the soul. It's almost as though these animals have souls in Dürer's drawings and paintings.
It's especially true for dogs.
Yeah, he loved dogs. There are dogs in so many of his pictures. There are in the famous picture of the knight, the death, and the devil. There's this loyal dog riding along underneath by the horse, the knight's horse, which is going through the Valley of Death. There's a dog asleep in the corner in St. Jerome's study. In the most famous, strangest engraving ever made, called Melancholia, there's a dog sleeping at the feet of an angel. Dogs always signify melancholy, I realized, at the time, but also, of course, loyalty, companionship, all the things, the way we think about dogs now.
You mentioned the knight, the death, and the devil. I think that's one of his... really fascinating and interesting works, and you write a lot about it. Talk to me for a little bit about The Knight, the Death, and the Devil, because that is such a powerful work.
almost a vision out of a science fiction movie or a horror movie. It's this knight. He's going through this dark, deep valley, which is overhung with crags and overgrown trees, and it's a ravine, and there's something very claustrophobic about it. His dog is with him, as I say. The horse is there. Horse has a sprig of oak leaves tied to his tail, which denotes loyalty as well and heroism. And he's waylaid by this rotten, decaying figure of death holding an hourglass, denoting his mortality, a figure of the devil trying to tempt him with these horned, strange, almost antelope-like horns on it. And it's there's something... when you're a kid, when you find a picture in a book that you're reading, and it's a kind of world, it's like Narnia or you know, Lord of the Rings, something fantastical that you can dive into. You feel as though you can dive into that picture, that you can be there. It has such depth. It really is. It's almost like CGI for a medieval period.
I know, and that's one of the things you try to do in the book is to get the reader to understand what these things would have appeared like to the person back at that time. And these would have been incredibly powerful, wonderful pictures.
Absolutely. And because he was the first artist to print his own work, these images become available. You don't have to be tremendously wealthy. You don't have to be a merchant, prince, or duke to be able to afford these pictures. You can buy them and paste them up on your wall. They were pasted up on wardrobe. Actually, sometimes people coloured them in, you know. It was like painting by numbers. But he's rather like Andy Warhol in that way. He was mass producing images. And these images went all around Europe. Even his rhinoceros ended up on the wall of a Colombian villa at the end of the 16th century. So it sort of travelled half the world with this image.
Wow. What I'm also amazed about is his use of color. Obviously, in the hair, you can see that. But two of the works that you reproduce in your book is the wing and the body of a blue roller, which is a kind of very colorful bird found especially around the Mediterranean in Europe. The color in that is vibrant. It's alive. It's amazing. It's an incredible use of color.
Almost like a bird of paradise, and
I've actually seen that species wild.
Oh, have you really?
Yeah.
Gosh. Wow, that's amazing, because we've just had one. I've never seen one. We had one stray one appear in England, southern England.
No, I had to go to Spain. I had to go to Spain to see it. But
I'd love to see one. It's such improbable colors, isn't it? It's like orange and turquoise.
But that's when you look at his work of that. It is. First of all, it's real. That's the way they look, and it's almost a Trump Wow painting.
Yeah.
Which is years, decades, centuries ahead of his time.
Yeah, and really, what people can't work out even now is why he took such care and attention to paint images like that, which he couldn't sell. They weren't saleable things, and it was so he was. People have explained it by saying there are studies for the angels of wings of angels, rather, or to be used in other paintings. And there is an aspect of that. But what I really see is something which I really tie into. He's doing it for the joy, beauty of the thing itself.
Right. That's exactly right. Now, there's just one of your little digressions, and I want to talk more about it. You barely mentioned this. There's another painting by another artist, painted in 1641, a maritime painting by Hendrik van Antoysen, Antonissen, where the stranded whale was painted over.
Yeah, it's bizarre. So so what happens? It's actually in the Fitzwilliam Museum in Cambridge here in the UK, and. It was a very unprepossessing, dark landscape, just of a sort of ordinary sort of seaside scene, fairly anodyne, not very exciting. And the curators decided to clean it. This was about 10 years ago. And when they did, they realized the reason why there were all these figures standing on the shore It's because they were standing around a whale, a stranded whale.
Wow.
Which someone painted out. And it's really, really remarkable. What? That was the reason why the painting was made in the first place. Someone painted it out. It's such a strange thing to do.
Do we not know why they did that? Was it like a later owner just finally said, I don't want to know stinking whale on my painting?
You know, I think that's probably exactly what it was, that it was a kind of ugly thing to them. You know, it was stinking, you know.
And it was, right, right.
Yeah. Dead whales do really smell.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is writer Philip Hoare. He's a professor of creative writing at the University of Southampton. And we're talking about his book. It is just a wonderful book to read. Albert and the Whale. Albrecht Dürer and How Art Imagines Our World. So in his lifetime, was Dürer recognized as a genius and a sort of prolific master artist?
He was, but not in his hometown. He was very annoyed about that. He writes to his best friend, he says, because he visits Venice, and everyone thinks I'm treated like a lord here, but back home I'm a parasite. He felt that in his hometown he hadn't transcended the notion of the artist as just an artisan, you know, little more than a furniture maker, really, with a good eye for detail. He realized what he was doing was extraordinary. And there's this great thing where he goes to Antwerp in 1520, just shortly before he sees the whale, and he goes and he's been invited to this dinner, and he's amazed because everyone stands up and claps as he comes into the room. That's a real point which he realizes, wow, you know, I've made it. so yeah, I think he does, and he's always having these dreams. He has these amazing dreams all the time, and one he dreams of this golden age in the future when all artists will be appreciated for what they do, as opposed to being sort of just a kind of work person, you know.
There's a sentence in your book that really gets people to understand the impact of imagery back in the 16th century. He said in the 1500s, an ordinary person could expect to see fewer handmade images in a lifetime than we see in like an hour or 5 minutes.
Yeah, if you imagine, you know, when you're on your computer today and you're entering something into a search engine, you enter Albert Dürer into a search engine,
oh, yeah.
You see all his works in a few seconds. An ordinary person, the only time they'd really see works of art would be in a church, you know. But suddenly, because of printing, suddenly they're there. And his first realization of the power of this is when he prints a series called The Apocalypse, and they're his images of the Book of Revelation. So it's like the four horsemen of the apocalypse. It's all the, you know, dragons being fought by angels in the sky. And it really is. It is the equivalent of cinema or TV or YouTube for us now. You know, that's what it is. It's YouTube for the year 1500. And his extraordinary imagination is such that Erasmus, the great philosopher who knew Dürer and knew his work, he said, Dürer does in black and white what other artists can only do in color.
Well, you have a great phrase for that in the book is, he gave you more ink per square inch than anybody else. His engravings are dense, and so there's more there in a single work than most people would see in any other work.
And even now, modern contemporary artists I know who are real masters at engraving, still cannot reproduce Dürer's work.
Yeah,
inch for inch, they can't do it.
Now, as the book proceeds, all sorts of odd things happen. Suddenly it becomes a meditation on Faust and the different Fausts. All the different Fausts, and then specifically Thomas Mann. Talk to me about your interest in Thomas Mann.
Well, it was sparked because I found this reference to Thomas Mann's last great novel, Dr. Faustus, which was written in Los Angeles, where Thomas Mann, a great German writer, had fled Nazi Germany. He taught at Princeton, and he lived for quite a time, 3 or 4 years, in Los Angeles, near Venice Beach. And he was horrified at what had happened to German culture under the Nazis. He was specifically horrified at what they had done to Dürer. They'd adopted Dürer as, quote, the most German of German artists. And this seemed like such an anathema, an abomination to Thomas Mann. So in his book, Dr. Faustus, which is it's an extraordinary book in which he takes an avant-garde composer of his time and sort of translates him to Dürer. He's almost this person becomes Dürer. So Dürer's genius becomes the genius of this composer for creating modernistic works. And you see the threat to modern culture that totalitarianism represents, and you see that what Mann is saying is that this is what happens when, you know, you pervert art for your own ends. But even more than that, I think Mann is so... he's such a great storyteller that you really believe this kind of strange... this guy is like Faust, you know. It's like Mephistopheles has offered this composer the potential to be the greatest artist if he sells his soul to the devil. And what I discovered when I was writing the book is actually Dürer was in the same palace, same castle in Bamberg, the neighboring town to Nuremberg, as the original Faust. When the original Faust, Johannes Faust, was there, was casting the horoscope for the prince who lived in this castle. And I can pretty much now say that they were actually in the same building at the same time. It's difficult to be completely exact about that, but this notion that did Dürer sell his soul for this art?
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's what fascinates me.
It's all sorts of other little bits crop up throughout your telling. Like you describe Buddenbrooks, one of Mann's most well-known works, as satisfying as a Dürer drawing. The Magic Mountain, the sanatorium, is overwhelming melancholy. Again, one of the most important works by Dürer. And then there are connections to the ocean in Thomas Mann, too. He's reading the account of William Beebe about traveling to the depths in the bathyscape. And then that sense of in Death in Venice, the story, and I love this description of it, the voluptuousness of doom. And that reminds me of The Night, the Death, and the Devil. I mean, there's that kind of overlap of sensibilities that's going on in your book.
That's exactly it. Because Thomas Mann is experiencing this same aesthetic that Dürer is buying into, the same aesthetic that you and I are experiencing as we read about these things, that I felt about in the 1970s when I was getting into people like David Bowie, who...
who crops up in this book, by the way, several times.
Yeah, he does. Because art is a time machine. You can get into, you know, you can travel in time and space. The contemporary philosopher Timothy Morton, wonderful philosopher, sort of eco-philosopher, talks about art as being all art is from the future. Art imagines the future and the past at the same time. So you can be in all these different places at the same time through what the artist is channeling. It's almost like a seance in a way. And I think at the back of the book was a bit like that. It felt as though I was channeling all these people, and they were coming into my head in a way.
One of the most fascinating characters in more recent is Marianne Moore, the editor of Dial magazine. She essentially became Dürer.
She sort of falls in love with him. She becomes him and also sees him. She talks about... so she sees him, his work in the Met in 1928, which is his the 400th anniversary of his death. There's a big show of his work at the Met in New York, and she realizes it's like, oh, I've been here before.
Yeah.
She talks about, and when she sees a portrait, she sees images of Joe. She talks about his magnificence in apparel. You can see she's not only falling in love with him, but she is inhabiting his aesthetic. So she starts to channel him, and she's living in Brooklyn, but she suddenly imagines she's Dürer seeing whales standing on the shore of Brooklyn, of the bay
wow,
in Brooklyn.
Wow.
And her paint, her drawings, her poems are like paintings or Jura's drawings. They have those details. They just fall into the world, the natural world.
I love the description of you getting some very close-up and personal views of Dürer's work. I've been in situations like that myself, and it's very special if it's an artist that you're fascinated by. You even get to at least hold a piece of Dürer.
Yeah.
Don't say what. Sell books. Don't say what.
Okay, I won't. But you know, it's when you see a work by an artist, even an artist that's, you know, 500 years old, their genes are there.
That's right.
Their spit and their hair and they are there. So, yeah, it's something very special when you actually see something like that. There's something really...
Well, when you've only seen it reproduced, when you finally see the actual work face-to-face, it's a much different experience. The size is different. The detail is incredible. I remember, I forget who was showing you the hair, but he pointed out that he outlined each whisker with a tiny line of white to make it stand out.
That completely blew me away, because you could suddenly you could see him with a single hair brush, just lining the whisker of the hair, and the way that was just the theatricality of that thing, of what he did there, and suddenly the whiskers vibrate, and the hair is twitching on its haunches, and it's there, it's a living creature. And that's a very fragile image, that painting. It's a watercolor. It's kept at the Albertina Gallery Museum in Vienna, and they only show it every 10 years because of its fragility. So to have a personal audience with it was as though the curator had opened this box and the hair had leapt out and was there in front of me.
We're going to have to end it there. My guest tonight has been writer Philip Hoare. He's a professor of creative writing at the University of Southampton, and we've been talking about his book, which I recommend it highly, Albert and the Whale, Albrecht Dürer and How Art Imagines Our World. Philip, it's been a real pleasure.
It's a huge pleasure for me. Thank you so much, Mark.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.